This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil via remote. A Russian court has now rejected an appeal by a U.S. basketball star Brittany Griner of her 9-year prison sentence for drug possession, which was, in fact, a step that would have made her possible the high-stake prisoner swap between Moscow and Washington. The All-Star Center with the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury and 2-time Olympic gold medalist was convicted on August 4th after police said they found vape canisters containing cannabis oil in her luggage at a Moscow airport. Reflecting pressure on the U.S. administration to do more to bring Griner home, the U.S. Secretary of State revealed in July that Washington had made a proposal to get Griner home. That was along with Paul Whelan, an American serving a 16-year sentence in Russia for a conviction there. The news that Rishi Sunak has now become Britain's first prime minister of color was welcomed by many among Britain's large Indian and South Indian communities. Sunak, who is 42, will be the first Hindu and the first person of South Asian descent to lead a country that has a long history of colonialism and has often struggled to welcome immigrants from its former colonies and continues to grapple with racism and other issues. Now, while Sunak's ascent was welcomed as a sign of visible diversity, his background of wealth and privilege is not the norm, and some say more work needs to be done in those areas. This is VOA News. A new report from doctors and other health experts says that the world's fossil fuel addiction is making the world sicker and it's killing more people. It says that the heat deaths are up 68%. And among vulnerable groups, in that each year pollution from the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas is killing about 1.2 million people worldwide. The Lancet report looks at 43 different health indicators. Report authors say that the global health problems from global warming are actually getting worse. Ukraine's nuclear energy operator says that Russian forces have performed secret work at Europe's largest nuclear power plant. The activity could shed light on Russia's unsubstantiated claims that Kyiv's forces are now preparing what it called a provocation involving a radioactive device. A Ukrainian nuclear power operator, Energocom, said Tuesday it assumes the Russians are preparing a terrorist act using nuclear materials and radioactive waste stored at that plant. It says the destruction of containers of spent nuclear fuel would lead to a radiation accident and the contamination of several hundred square kilometers of adjacent territory. Ukraine has dismissed Moscow's claim as an attempt to distract attention from the Kremlin's own alleged plans to detonate a dirty bomb. In the U.S. city of Los Angeles, detectives continue to investigate whether a recording last year that captured a city council member's racist remarks was made illegally. Disclosure of the recording earlier this month unleashed a citywide scandal that occurred just weeks before Election Day. The council president, Mary Martinez, resigned in disgrace while two other council members have resisted widespread calls for their ousters. The group approached the Los Angeles Police Department on Friday and asked for the agency to begin an investigation. The LAPD Chief Michael Moore announced the opening of the case on Tuesday during a media availability in response to a question from the Associated Press. Recapping our top story, a Russian court has now rejected an appeal by U.S. basketball star Brittany Griner of her 9-year prison sentence for drug possession, which a step could have made her closer to a possible high-stakes prisoner swap between Moscow and Washington. More at VOAnews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, October 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine accuses Russian forces of secret work at Europe's largest nuclear power plant as fears of a, quote, dirty bomb, unquote, grow.
A dirty bomb is when an entity, be it a country, be it a terrorist organization, uses something that's not completely a nuclear weapon, but it has some radioactive material in it.
Finland and Sweden's aspiration to join NATO in doubt as Turkey renews objections.
The meeting marked the latest diplomatic effort by Helsinki to persuade Ankara to agree to its bid to join NATO. For the Atlantic Alliance to expand, all members must agree.
And Pakistan sets up a commission to investigate the killing of a well-known Pakistani journalist in Kenya. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine's nuclear energy operator says Russian forces have performed secret work at Europe's largest nuclear power plant. The activity could shed light on Russia's unsubstantiated claims that Kyiv forces are preparing a, quote, provocation, unquote, involving a radioactive device. Ukrainian nuclear operator Energyatom said Tuesday it, quote, assumes, unquote, the Russians are preparing a terrorist act using nuclear materials and radioactive wastes stored at the plant. Russia denies the charge. This as Washington deployed the elite 101st Airborne Division, known as the, quote, Screaming Eagles, unquote, for the first time in 80 years, close to Ukraine's border. For more, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob.
A dirty bomb is when an entity, be it a country, be it a terrorist organization, uses something that's not completely a nuclear weapon, but it has some radioactive material in it. It's not strong enough to be considered a nuclear weapon, but it still has major consequences. I mean, imagine radiation being spilled out of a certain area. And so that is why the Pentagon has said repeatedly that should anyone use nuclear weapons, should anyone use dirty bombs, chemical weapons, there will be serious repercussions. And the Pentagon has made clear that any accusations by the Russians that the Ukrainians are trying to use a dirty bomb are false. That has been stated over the last several days. They call this some sort of Russian disinformation campaign.
Talking about consequences, Carla, for a country and for a leader who has ignored all international pleas from the United Nations and from other countries, what are the consequences? Has the administration, the Pentagon, spelled out what the consequences would be if Russia indeed goes ahead and uses a dirty bomb?
They haven't come out and explicitly said what the exact repercussions would be. If nuclear weapons were used, that could start World War III, because NATO, the U.S., they have nuclear capabilities to respond to any nuclear capabilities used by a Russia, perhaps. But the United States is trying to prevent anything like this from happening. So that would be an absolute last resort.
There are reports that the 101st Elite Airborne is close to the Ukrainian border. What does this mean, and why is the Pentagon redeploying this elite force?
This goes back to how the United States and the Pentagon have restructured their force posture across Europe. So this isn't something that's happening based on something going on this week. These are rotations that have been happening since the buildup to the invasion of Ukraine. And then when Russia initially invaded Ukraine, NATO said we have to fortify our borders with Russia, and we have to fortify our borders with Ukraine as well. Should Russians coming through Ukraine or through Belarus try to invade NATO that way? So this is part of that effort that has been ongoing for months. We do know that the 101st are there now with the Romanians, practicing some live exercises, preparing for a potential invasion. That's something that they do with allies and partners across the globe. It's not special to just Europe.
That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Britain's new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said on Tuesday he will try to fix the mess left by his predecessor, restore faith in politics and tackle, quote, profound economic crisis, unquote, but warned the country there will be difficult decisions. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
I've just been to Buckingham Palace and accepted His Majesty the King's invitation to form a government in his name.
Rishi Sunak made his first speech as Britain's Prime Minister on Tuesday, promising to rebuild confidence and lead the country through an economic crisis.
It has been a huge honour.
That after the 44 days of turmoil under the person he replaces, former leader Liz Truss, who resigned after her economic policies, called the mini-budget, sparked chaos in financial markets. Speaking outside his new Downing Street residence, Sunak said he was ready for the challenges brought by the premiership as the UK races towards a recession.
I want to pay tribute to my predecessor, Liz Truss, but some mistakes were made. Not born of ill will or bad intentions. Quite the opposite, in fact. But mistakes nonetheless. And I have been elected as leader of my party and your Prime Minister, in part, to fix them. I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
42-year-old Sunak, a former hedge fund boss, has only been in elected politics for 7 years. He'll be tasked with bringing an end to infighting in Westminster, feuding that has horrified investors and alarmed international allies.
But I am not daunted. I know the high office I have accepted, and I hope to live up to its demands. But when the opportunity to serve comes along, you cannot question the moment, only your willingness. So I stand here before you, ready to lead our country into the future.
Sunak, one of the richest men in Parliament, is expected to slash spending to plug a $45 billion hole in public finances. That's been created by the economic slowdown, higher borrowing costs, and a six-month programme of support for people's energy bills. As the Conservative Party's popularity wanes, Sunak will also face growing appetite for an election, especially if he deviates too far from the policy manifesto that saw the Tories elected in 2019, when then-leader Boris Johnson pledged to invest heavily in the country. Economists and investors have claimed Sunak's appointment will calm markets. But they warn that he has few easy options when millions are battling the cost of living crunch. He also vowed to put the public's need above politics, reflecting mounting anger at the sense of perma-crisis that has gripped Britain since the 2016 Brexit referendum. Some ministers from Truss's cabinet have already resigned, including Business Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg and Justice Minister Brandon Lewis, though Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt will remain in his post.
Good morning.
Britain's youngest Prime Minister for more than 200 years and its first leader of colour, Sunak has warned his colleagues that they face an existential crisis. They do not help steer the country through surging inflation and the record energy bills, forcing many to cut back on spending.
That's Lauren Anthony of Reuters. Finland and Sweden's aspirations to join NATO are in doubt as Ankara has renewed its objections to their membership bids. A Finnish delegation visited Ankara Tuesday in the latest diplomatic efforts to assuage Turkish concerns. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, looming elections in Turkey are a complicating factor.
Finnish diplomats held a day of talks in Ankara with their Turkish counterparts, according to local media reports. The meeting marked the latest diplomatic effort by Helsinki to persuade Ankara to agree to its bid to join NATO. For the Atlantic Alliance to expand, all members must agree. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has voiced reservations over Finland and Sweden's bid to join, accusing the countries of giving sanctuary to Kurdish groups that Ankara considers terrorists. Speaking to Parliament earlier this month, Erdogan said he would closely monitor commitments by both Finland and Sweden to address Turkish concerns. Erdogan said, Turkey is not going to give concessions as a country that has fought terrorism for 40 years. Earlier in October, the Turkish leader accused Stockholm of reneging on its commitments to Ankara, saying enemies of Turkey were continuing to operate freely in Sweden. Erdogan, however, said he was ready to meet with Sweden's newly elected Prime Minister, Ulf Kristersson, to discuss Turkish demands. Hussein Baja, head of the Foreign Policy Institute in Ankara, says Erdogan sees NATO expansion as an opportunity.
Tayyip Erdogan
tries to increase the leverage of Turkish bargaining process through this. Maybe at the end he will say yes, but he has to take now something. It is a calculated act, but whether it will be a miscalculation or not, we will see this.
News reports say Sweden has made many security concessions. Ankara is demanding the extradition of dozens of people, including Swedish nationals, wanted for terrorist offences. Analyst Ilhan Uzgel with the Duvar news portal says concessions from Washington are Erdogan's main aim.
The membership bit of Finland and Sweden. He tries to use these two bargaining chips to get something from the West. It can be either a meeting of Biden, it can be the purchase of F-16 fighter jets from the United States, external support during the elections, something that will help Erdogan to get a better position before the elections.
Erdogan is languishing in most opinion polls ahead of elections that Turkey is required to hold by June of 2023. Analyst Uzgil says Erdogan will be reluctant to give up leverage over NATO before the June polls. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is calling on Malaysian authorities to stop forcible deportation of asylum seekers from Myanmar back to their home country, where agency officials say their lives are at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says these forced returns from Malaysia have been going on since April. Over the past 2 months, UNHCR officials report hundreds of Myanmar nationals have been sent back against their will. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu says the latest incident occurred on Friday when Malaysian authorities defied agency efforts and deported an asylum seeker who was being held in detention. Mantu says sending people seeking international protection back to Myanmar exposes them to harm and danger.
The principle of non-refoulement is a cornerstone of international law and is binding on all states. The situation in Myanmar is forcing people to flee to seek safety within the country and across borders. We actually don't have information on what happens to these deportees once they arrive, and that's why we continue to urge that they are not sent to Myanmar against their will.
The UNHCR has registered more than 183,000 refugees and asylum seekers in Malaysia. They include nearly 106,000 Rohingya and some 52,000 other people from ethnic groups fleeing conflict and persecution in Myanmar. Observers say at least 17,500 people are being held in 21 immigration detention centers across the country, including more than 1,500 children. Human Rights Watch reports Malaysia has forcibly returned more than 2,000 Myanmar nationals since April, more than half in the past 2 months. Mantu says the UNHCR does not know why this surge of deportations is happening now. But she notes her agency is very concerned about the humanitarian consequences for people affected by this.
We are in continuous dialogue and engaging with authorities there on the issue. And this is an ongoing intervention that we're making. But I don't really have any more feedback than that. But we are continuing our interventions with the authorities and hope that this will stop.
The UN Refugee Agency is reiterating its call to other states in the region to continue offering protection to Myanmar nationals fleeing for safety. It also is urging the Malaysian government to end the practice of indefinitely detaining asylum seekers and refugees from Myanmar. A recent report by the UN Human Rights Office accuses Myanmar's military leaders of arresting thousands of people and subjecting them to physical abuse, ill-treatment, and torture, sometimes resulting in death. Myanmar's military government has not responded to this latest report, but has rejected similar reports in the past. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, Pakistan will set up a judicial commission to investigate the killing of a well-known Pakistani journalist in a police shooting in Kenya. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif said on Tuesday, a Kenyan police report says Ashad Sharif was shot dead in Nairobi on Sunday when police opened fire on a vehicle he was traveling in as he drove through their roadblock without stopping. The shooting sparked outrage in Pakistan. He said he would ensure a transparent investigation. It was not immediately clear what the terms of reference or jurisdiction of the commission would be given since the death occurred in a foreign country. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Dofo in Washington. South Africa's presidential spokesperson says the first round of peace talks on Ethiopia's Tigray region has begun. Few other details have been released, and so far, there has been no media access to the venue at an unknown location in South Africa. Kate Butler reports from Johannesburg.
South African presidential spokesman Vincent Magwenya told reporters on Tuesday that the talks, which had previously been delayed, were underway.
The peace talks, which have been convened to find a peaceful and sustainable solution to the devastating conflict in the Tigray region, started today, the 25th of October, and will end on the 30th of October.
Word of the discussions comes after the Ethiopian government side and the leadership of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, confirmed they had left for South Africa on Monday. The talks are being led by former Nigerian leader and the African Union's Horn of Africa envoy, Olusegun Obasanjo, along with South Africa's former deputy president, Phumzile Mlamo Nkuka, and Kenya's former president, Uhuru Kenyatta. The African Union Commission said in a statement that representatives of the United Nations and the United States government were participating as observers. AU Commission Chairman Moussa Faki Mahamat said he was encouraged by the early demonstration of commitment to peace by the parties and to seek a lasting political solution to the conflict in the supreme interest of Ethiopia. The statement added, the chairperson reiterates the AU's continued commitment to support the parties in an Ethiopian-owned and AU-led process to silence the guns towards a united, stable, peaceful and resilient Ethiopia. Fighting in Tigray has intensified over the past week, with the Ethiopian government aiming to seize the region's airports and other infrastructure. The government said Monday its forces had continued taking control of major urban centers in the past few days. Tens of thousands of people have been killed and millions more displaced since the Tigray conflict broke out in November 2020. The TPLF dominated Ethiopian politics for decades before being sidelined when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took office in 2018. Abiy was initially seen as a peacemaker after settling Ethiopia's long-running conflict with neighboring Eritrea. That image, however, has been shattered by the war in Tigray, and human rights groups have accused both sides of atrocities. The United States and European Union have both expressed hope the peace talks in South Africa will be successful. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Kate. And for the first time, women will hold a majority of seats in the New Zealand Parliament after Labour lawmaker Soraya Pekis-Mason was sworn in on Tuesday. Phil Mercer reports.
In New Zealand's Parliament in Wellington, Soraya Pekis-Mason has been celebrated as a trailblazer. The Māori politician was sworn in Tuesday as the newest member of the governing Labour Party. There are now more women than men in Parliament for the first time. Pekis-Mason told Radio New Zealand Tuesday that female representation in Parliament has been building momentum for some time.
Oh, absolutely. Look, no doubt it's a special day for me, but it's also a historic occasion for Aotearoa New Zealand, so pretty significant. It was only a matter of time, I think, that this would come to the fore, given the inclusiveness of our country now.
However, National Party lawmaker Judith Collins told local media Tuesday that gender advances in politics didn't mean that all women in New Zealand would be treated fairly, and insisted that there was more work to do. In 1893, New Zealand became the first country to allow women to vote in parliamentary elections. It would be another 25 years before Canada and Britain did the same. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said Tuesday's gender milestone in New Zealand politics was significant and heartening. Pekis-Mason is also the first new lawmaker to have pledged allegiance to the new king, Charles III. The British monarch is New Zealand's head of state. The number of women in New Zealand's parliament remained very low until the 1990s. Female participation was boosted in 1996 when a new voting system, mixed member proportional representation, was introduced. New Zealand is a South Pacific nation with a population of about 5 million people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including 30 House of Representative progressive Democrats are calling on President Biden to shift his strategy on Ukraine ahead of midterm elections to pursue direct diplomacy with Russia to end the months-long conflict. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey there, it's Shauna Renee, also known as the Lady DJ, inviting you to join me every Thursday at 10 and 2200 UTC for today's Hit Countdown. Each week, I count down the top 20 songs in pop music according to Billboard and Rolling Stone magazines, but more importantly, according to you, the VOA listeners. Again, that's Thursdays at 10 and 2200 UTC right here on VOA 1.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out VOA Africa for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will live up to its commitments in the Indo-Pacific. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said in a recent interview, "We continue to work to make sure that we have the right capabilities in the right places to ensure that we help our allies maintain a free and open Indo-Pacific." When asked about the People's Republic of China's increased military activity and incursions into the Taiwan Strait, Secretary of Defense Austin said, "China is moving to establish what we would call a new normal. We saw a number of centerline crossings of the Taiwan Strait by their aircraft, and that number has increased over time. We've seen more activity in their surface vessels in the waters in and around Taiwan." The defense secretary stressed that the United States does not want to see a unilateral change to the status quo regarding Taiwan, and that the One China policy of the United States has not changed. He noted that in accordance with the Taiwan Relations Act, we're committed to helping Taiwan develop the capability to defend itself, and that work has gone on over time. It will continue into the future. Last month on her trip to Asia, Vice President Kamala Harris underscored the same commitment in her remarks aboard the USS Howard in Yokosuka, Japan. She noted the PRC's disturbing behavior in the East China Sea and in the South China Sea, and most recently provocations across the Taiwan Strait. "We will continue to oppose any unilateral change to the status quo," the vice president said, "and we will continue to support Taiwan's self-defense consistent with our long-standing policy." Taiwan, she stated, is a vibrant democracy that contributes to the global good, from technology to health and beyond, and the United States will continue to deepen our unofficial ties. The United States does not seek conflict or a Cold War with the PRC. "In fact," said Vice President Harris, "we will work with every willing nation to solve global challenges." "The United States is a proud Pacific power," the vice president declared. "The presence of the United States in the Indo-Pacific is in pursuit of peace and stability and to support our allies and partners."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.